Numbers chapters 27, 31, and 32, the 13th talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on July 24, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to be finishing the narrative portion of Numbers today. We're just going to look, there's not much left. We're just going to look at part of chapter 27, and then we'll look at chapter 31, and a little, and I'll kind of summarize chapter 32. But before we do that, I'd like to go backwards. There were a couple of questions that were asked last week, and I spent some time looking into those and would like to address those before we launch into 27. As you will recall, we looked at the incident at Baal Peor last week. And in the first portion of that description in chapter 25, starting with, well, I'll read the first five verses, and then I want to talk about verse 4 in particular. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor. And the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. And last week I talked about the command from God being to take all the leaders of the people and execute them, that was God's way of dealing with this problem of the people's faithlessness and turning to this other god, the Moabite gods. This was God's way of dealing with that. But then Moses, his instruction is, he said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. If the leaders of the people and the judges of Israel are the same group, then Moses has changed what God had told him to do, and I talked about that last week. But someone raised the question, Ryan Garrity, I think, raised the question, in verse 4, could it be when it says, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight, that the them refers to the guilty people, the people who have been have been faithless. Okay, that the issue there is we have a pronoun, them, and the question is, to what does it refer? A pronoun is just a way of economizing in language. That if I'm talking about Fred, let's make it longer, Frederick the Great, and I don't want to always say Frederick the Great, that after I've established who I'm talking about, I can from then on use he as a way of economizing. So that's essentially what a pronoun does. It's just a way of economizing. But if I just stand up here and say, he was a very good guy, that's meaningless unless you know to whom it refers. And that to which a pronoun refers is called the antecedent. So the question is, what is the antecedent of them? And I was just playing around and created a sentence, and then I'll play with this a little bit more. But let's say my kids come into the house, they're all sandy. Or a kid comes in to a house. And we have this sentence, the man took his children outside and washed them. Who does the them refer to? Well, the only thing that would make sense to anyone, the first thing that would come to mind is the them refers to the children. The man took his children outside and washed those children. In that kind of sentence, and I patterned that after the verse here in verse 4, that God told Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them. So it's the same kind of construction. Would it ever be possible for that them to refer to something other than the children? Well, let me build the scenario a little bit more. This man found several cute kittens in his barn. This is frankly unimaginable to me, but we'll proceed with this anyway. The man found several cute kittens in his barn. They were very dirty and very active, so the man went into his house to get help to clean them up. Now let's have the same sentence. The man took his children outside and washed them. Now, could the them refer to the kittens? It could. It's a little strained. It's a little strained. And we would, as native speakers of the language, we would try to avoid that kind of situation where the them, what it's referring to, is ambiguous. Okay, so could them refer to something other than the leaders in the sentence? I would argue, yes, it could, but it's not the first thing that would come to mind. And furthermore, a separate group, people who have been disobedient, is not mentioned prior to this sentence. So that makes it even less likely. So I think, is it possible that them refers to someone else? It is possible. One of my favorite commentators on the Old Testament, Kyle, I don't know what his first name is, the German commentator, he thinks that this refers to the people who have been guilty. The them refers to the people who have been guilty. So if someone like that says it's possible, I listen to it. But I think it's unlikely, nevertheless. But in looking at this, I started thinking, it is curious that in verse 4 it refers to all the leaders of the people. That's what God says, take all the leaders of the people. And then in verse 5 it says, Moses said to the judges of Israel. Those are two different expressions. I had just assumed earlier that it was the same group of people. He was just using two different terms to refer to the same group of people. In both instances, it's essentially the leaders of Israel. That is possible. But it's also possible that since they're two different expressions, that the author wants to clue us that he's actually talking about a different group. So I started playing with the idea of what could the leaders of the people mean other than the judges. And it seems to me that the leaders of the people could mean the ringleaders. That is, those people who instigated the lawlessness, those people who instigated the rebelliousness. Now, I looked for precedents for that and could not find precedents for that. I couldn't find another instance where this expression refers to the ringleaders of the people, or the demagogues, or whatever. But this expression is not common, so it only occurs 4 or 5 times. So, I think it's possible, but it's not. It's certainly not definite. Then the other question that I looked into was one that Melanie raised. In verse 9, we have the first reference to a plague. It says, and those who died by the plague were 24,000. So I looked to see what kinds of things come under the category of plague. And generally speaking, it's some kind of natural affliction on people that is sent by God. But there is an instance in which the Philistines routed the Israelites. The Israelites had been faithless. They went to battle against the Philistines, and they were routed. And it refers to that as a plague. So an instance in which people are slaughtered and God's hand is clearly evident in that slaughter, that too can be referred to as a plague. So it seems like in this case it's possible that what happened is Moses told the judges to take those people who had been guilty and slay them, and that process had begun. People were being executed, and it wasn't then until Phinehas killed the man and the Midianite woman who flagrantly came to the tent of meeting in their rebelliousness, and Phinehas ran them through with a spear, that then the killing stopped. So I think it's very possible that the plague here is referring to the executions that God had commanded be carried out. Okay. So that's my report on the assignments I received last week. Okay. So what happens after the incident at Baal Peor? The next thing, next in chapter 26, we have a census. Remember, the book of Numbers began with a census. There was a census taken at that time when they were still in the wilderness. They were just still south of the promised land. And God was just preparing to move them into position to then go in and conquer the promised land. And the census was taken at that time. And a census is usually taken before a nation goes to war. And so that census was taken before this war of the Exodus, as I'm thinking of it. This war that led up to them being on the doorstep of the promised land. Now another census is taken at the end of Numbers, and this is in preparation for another war, and this is the war of conquest going into the promised land. The book of Numbers, by the way, gets its name from the fact that there are these two censuses in the book. Then after the census is taken, there's a brief description of the law of inheritance and some clarification as to how that will apply with respect to females. And then the part that I want to look at, Numbers 27, verses 12 through 23, in which leadership is passed from Moses to Joshua. So let's read that. Okay, 12 through the end of the chapter. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go up to this mountain in Abarim and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. And when you have seen it, you too shall be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother was. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin." Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, and who will lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd." So the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar, the priest, and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. And you shall put some of your authority on him, in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command, They shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. And Moses did just as the Lord commanded him. And he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. So God tells Moses that what had happened to his brother Aaron is going to happen to him. That is, he is going to be taken up on a mountaintop, and his life will be taken. He will die there. It says that he's to go to the mountain of Ibarim. That apparently is a range of mountains. In Deuteronomy, where it talks about Moses' death, it is more specific, and it gives the name of the actual peak on which he dies. But this is a set of mountains. But it is a set of mountains on the east side of the Jordan. From that vantage point, he is able to look across the Jordan into the land that God had given to Abraham, and the land that the people of Israel are going to go in to take. So he's going to be able to see it, but he isn't going to be able to enter into it. Why not? Because of what he had done in the wilderness of Zin. Now, we talked about this when we were there. I don't remember how long ago that was. But let me go back and read that very briefly. Numbers 28 through 13. As you will recall, throughout the trip through the Sinai, the Israelites had been a complaining people. They complained frequently, and primarily complained about Moses' leadership. And God would refer the complaint, or Moses would refer the complaints to God, and God would meet those concerns and take care of the people of Israel. And he did that consistently throughout the Exodus. This was one of those instances in which the people complained because they didn't have water, and this was after there had been many others. And in this case, Moses brought water out of the rock. So let me read just chapter 28. I'll just read through 13. Take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. So this was the incident in which, because of Moses' action, he was not allowed to go into the promised land. Now, what is the nature of the wrong that Moses has done here? I am blessed with a poor memory. I do not remember what I said when we taught this, but there is a certain amount of clarity and hopefully that has come in the last couple of weeks, and so hopefully it's helpful. This is a situation in which Moses consistently has acted on behalf of God and brought about miraculous solutions to the problems that the people have brought to Moses' attention, whether it was bringing water where there was no water, bringing meat where there was no meat, bringing bread where there was no bread. All of those were things that God did through the instrument of Moses. So Moses has consistently been the one who performed these miracles, or at least was the agent through whom these miracles were performed. And that's happened a number of times. And now it's a place where they need water, and God has told Moses to take his rod and to speak to the rock, and the rock will bring forth water. But the description is very interesting. What Moses actually says and does is, he says, "Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" So, listen now, you rebels. Moses, in the way that he describes this, is setting himself apart. You guys are the faithless ones. You are the rebels. And that's interesting because we've seen elsewhere where Moses has identified with his people, but here he's putting distance between them. And then he says, "Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" So it's like Moses and God are working together on this, bringing these miracles to be. Then in his actions, he takes the rod and he strikes the rock twice with that rod. And there's a sense in which he's turned this into a more dramatic thing where his action is bringing this about. And that was not what was instructed by God. Putting all the pieces together, I think what's happened here is that Moses has come to see these opportunities that God has given him to be an instrument of God in bringing, in rescuing the people of Israel from one problem or another. He's begun to see that as something that is inherently his. That Moses is doing these things. And that is a very easy thing for any of us to do. Because if you think about it, everything that we do is a gift from God. If we have any giftedness, it is from God. If we are artistically gifted, if we are intellectually gifted, if we are financially gifted, I mean, any kind of giftedness, that is a gift from God. And it is not inherently ours. It is very easy to take that for granted and think, that is mine. That can't be taken away from me. But the fact is, all of those can be taken away from you. Even your life is a gift. Your next breath is a gift. And that too could be taken away from you. But it's really easy to think, no, that's me. No, that's mine. And it's hard to keep things in perspective and realize that's not the case. It's easy to take whatever God gives us for granted. And I think Moses has done that here. He's taken it for granted. That he's taken for granted his position as this instrument that God uses to bring about these miracles, and has lost perspective. And as a result of that arrogance, he will not enter into the promised land. It says elsewhere, I'm pretty sure it's in Numbers, that Moses was the most humble man, I think it says the most humble man that ever lived. I take that seriously. I think Moses was a humble man. But it's possible even for a humble man to lose track of what it is that we get from God and take it for granted. Okay, so that is the reason, I think, that Moses is not being allowed to enter into the promised land. That was an act of arrogance. And as a result of that act of arrogance, God is not going to allow him into the promised land. To go into the promised land is very different from entering into the kingdom of God. To enter into the promised land is a temporal thing. It's really ultimately neither here nor there. So we aren't talking about Moses' soul in eternity. We're talking about a temporal thing that was denied to him because of his arrogance. That has nothing to do with his eternal destination. Okay, so Moses is going to die. And what Moses realizes is, you know, he's become familiar with the people of Israel and what a difficult group that is to lead. They are very rebellious. They are very anti-authoritarian. And they have demonstrated that time after time. Well, now he's going to die. And there's going to be a power vacuum. And that's what he's trying to address here. He says, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh," that expression, "the God of the spirits of all flesh," only occurs one other time in the Old Testament. And that was at the time of the rebellion of Korah, in which Korah and his men were challenging Moses and Aaron's right to lead the people of Israel. So once again, that was a context in which there was a crisis of authority, crisis of leadership. So I think that's the way that Moses is seeing this. And his question is, who will go out and come in before them, and who will lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd? He knows how disastrous it would be if they are going in to conquer the promised land, and these terms to go in and go and come out, those are military terms. So he knows that if they are going in to conquer the promised land, that's a military endeavor. And taking on a military endeavor like that without leadership is going to be catastrophic. So the question is, where is that leadership going to come from? And it's going to be Joshua who will do that. Joshua has been referred to on two different occasions in Numbers prior to this. One occasion was when he was one of the spies who went in to spy out the land when God had told them first to go in and take it. There were 12 spies that went in. Two of them came back, 10 of them came back with reports saying, "We can't do it. Those people are too big. Their cities are too strong. We are not up to this challenge." But two of them came back and said, "Well, yeah, they're big. The cities are strong, etc., but let's go do it." It was Joshua and Caleb who were those two. So in that instance, Joshua showed his faithfulness towards God. The only other place that Joshua shows up is one verse that indicates that Joshua had become Moses' right-hand man. So Joshua has been an understudy for a period of time. It's not clear how long, a year, year and a half. But Joshua has been an understudy to Moses for a period of time. So it is Joshua then that God selects as being the one who will take Moses' place. And the way that this is to be done is that Joshua is supposed to be taken before the congregation, before all the people of Israel. And there's supposed to be a little ceremony in which Moses places his hand on Joshua and gives him some authority, some of Moses' authority. He does that in the presence of all of the people of Israel and with the high priest standing there right next to him. So it's a ceremony which indicates God's blessing on this transferal of power to Joshua. But it points out that he's supposed to stand before the priest Eleazar in verse 21, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. So this will happen in front of and in the presence of the high priest. And the high priest will be the one to whom Joshua will refer inquiries of the Lord. And the high priest will have, it just refers to the Urim. Elsewhere in the Bible, it refers to the Urim and the Thummim. No one knows what those are. But a scholarly guess is that they are two stones, two flat stones, that both have two colors. One color on one side, another color on the other side. And those are thrown up in the air, kind of like doing heads or tails with a coin. If they come down with different colors, then it has to be done again. If they come down with both the same color, if it's one color, then it's a yes, and if it's the other color, it's a no. So that is a scholarly guess. I don't know whether it's just some scholar who sat in his room and dreamed that up, or whether there's any basis, in fact, for that. In any case, the Urim and Thummim somehow serve to make it possible to get answers from God. And it is the high priest that has the Urim and Thummim. So, in this transference of power, it's kind of interesting that there is now a division of labor. That in the past, Moses has been the leader, and he has also been the one who has taken inquiries to God, directly to God. So both of those jobs were part of Moses' job description. But with Joshua, apparently that's going to be divided. Joshua will provide the leadership, but the high priest will be the one who takes inquiries before God. So, the ceremony is held, and Joshua is appointed then the leader to take Moses' place when Moses dies. So there will not be the power vacuum that Moses was afraid of. All right, one last battle in chapter 31. And I will only read the first 24 verses. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you will be gathered to your people." And Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war." So there were furnished from the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them, 1,000 from each tribe, to the war, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest to the war with them, and the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. So they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. And they killed the kings of Midian, along with the rest of their slain, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. And the sons of Israel captured the women of Midian with their young little ones, and all their cattle, and all their flocks, and all their goods they plundered. Then they burned all their cities where they lived, and all their camps with fire. And they took all the spoil and all the prey, both of man and of beast. And they brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the sons of Israel, to the camp at the plains of Moab, which are by the Jordan, opposite Jericho. And Moses and Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation, went out to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds, who had come from service in the war. And Moses said to them, "Have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known man intimately. But all the girls who have not known man intimately, spare for yourselves. And you, camp outside the camp 7 days, whoever has killed any person, and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves, you and your captives, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. And you shall purify for yourselves every garment and every article of leather and all the work of goat's hair and all articles of wood." Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to battle, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can stand the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it shall be clean. But it shall be purified with water for impurity. But whatever cannot stand the fire, you shall pass through the water. And you shall wash your clothes on the 7th day and be clean. And afterward, you may enter the camp." Now, this chapter is both forward-looking and backward-looking. It's forward-looking in that it's establishing the terms under which war will be conducted by the Israelites. That is, this is a special kind of war. And what God is requiring of them is that this be pure, that they do things in a way that respects the holiness of God. And that's to be done in the way they deal with the plunder that is taken, as well as how it's to be fought, and that they will be killing all of the adults of their opponents. So in that sense, it's forward-looking, and it establishes the standards for the war that's coming about. But it also ties back to the chapters that we've looked at previously in Numbers. In particular, it notes that one of the kings of the Midianites that was killed is Zur. It mentions that in verse 8. If you'll recall, Zur was mentioned as being the father of Cozbi, the Midianite woman that was flagrantly being was involved with an Israelite man that came to the door of the tent of meeting that Phinehas killed, put to death. So Cozbi's father is one that is specifically mentioned as one who was killed in this war. So in that sense, there's a vengeance that's being taken. Another one that's killed, that is looking back to previous chapters, is Balaam. Balaam, the seer that was brought down to Moab in order to curse the Israelites, and was unable to curse the Israelites. Remember, at the end of those chapters, it had said that Balaam went back, I think is the term that it uses. But it's not clear exactly what that refers to, but went back to what. But apparently he stayed in Midian and continued to have an impact on events there in Midian. Then, later in this chapter, it tells us, gives us a hint as to what he was doing in Midian. And that's in verse 16. Moses was angry because they hadn't killed all of the men and they hadn't killed all of the women. And he says in verse 16, "Behold, these," that is referring to the women, "these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor." So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. So that's a hint at what Balaam was doing. Now, there are other hints in the Bible with respect to what Balaam was doing, and we'll try to piece that stuff together. There are three other references to Balaam later in the Old Testament. Those references all talk about the fact that Balaam wanted to curse the Israelites but was unable. But they don't talk about the events after the blessings that he placed on the Israelites. In the New Testament, however, there are three mentions of Balaam, and we'll look at at least two of them. One is in 2 Peter 2:15. Okay, let's see. Let me just kind of summarize. Chapter 2 is talking about, it starts out talking about false prophets. It says, "But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves." And then it goes on to talk about various ways in which the people of God have been led astray and punished for doing so. And yet, God has been very capable of keeping his people faithful to him. Let's see. I'll start in verse 12. But these, and this is talking about rebellious people, but these, like unreasoning animals, born as creatures of instinct to be captured and killed, reviling where they have no knowledge, will in the destruction of those creatures also be destroyed. Suffering wrong is the wages of doing wrong. They count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery and that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children. Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression. For a dumb donkey, speaking with the voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. I'll stop there. That's one of the references. Another one is in Jude, verse 11. It says, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So it's talking about three different kinds of rebelliousness that we're all punished by God. And then the last one is Revelation 2:14. And this is the letter to Pergamum, starting in verse 12. The one who has the sharp two-edged sword says this, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast my name, and do not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you, because you have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit acts of immorality. Thus you also have some who in the same way hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Repent, therefore, or else I am coming to you quickly, and I will make war against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. I'll stop there. This is all very cryptic. It's interesting that it's all at the end of the New Testament. But the three rather cryptic references back to Balaam. But piecing together the clues, I think what has happened is Balaam did indeed want to curse the Israelites, but was unable to do so because he was scared to death. God had successfully sobered him with respect to deviating at all from what God told him to do. So instead of cursing the Israelites, he ended up blessing them. But Balaam apparently did not go back home. Balaam stayed there, befriend them, mix with them. And by mixing with them and befriending them, you can win them over culturally. That is, culturally, they will merge with you, and they will no longer be an enemy. They will no longer be a foe. If that's true, then what is described at the incident of Baal Peor, that is directly the result of Balaam's counsel. They were doing exactly what Balaam had counseled them to do, to subvert the Israelites' culture rather than to defeat them militarily. That's a very clever strategy. It's one that's been used historically a number of times, and a number of times very successfully, that it is possible to win over a people peacefully by just enculturating them rather than fighting them. In this case, however, and in general, I don't know that that's necessarily wrong. But in this case, it's different. Because God had selected out the Israelites to be his people. They were going to be a peculiar people that for whom he would shape their culture. He would give them their religion. And all of that, and then they are to be a beacon for the rest of the world. As they live that out, they establish truth for the rest of the world. They live out truth for the rest of the world and become a light for all of us. Balaam doesn't recognize, won't acknowledge the special mission that the people of Israel have. And as a result, he is interested in subverting that. And that is a very wicked thing. That is just as wicked, if not more wicked, than trying to fight the Israelites and prevent them from getting into the promised land at all. So Balaam, then, is one of the ones that's killed in this war against the Midianites. And so the vengeance of God is carried out. Balaam is killed, and the leaders of Midian are also killed. Okay, then in chapter 32, I won't read it, I'll just describe what happens there. There are two tribes among the Israelites that when they get to the other side of the Jordan, they're in the Transjordan area, and that area, as I understand it, has a lot of pasture land. So it's rolling hills with lots of grass. And the Israelites, as you'll recall, they brought flocks out of Egypt. So they've had herds and flocks throughout this expedition. They get to the other side of the Jordan, and there are two tribes that look at the land and they say, "This is nice. It is so much better than the Sinai Desert. This is good enough. Why don't we just stay here?" So they go to Moses and they say, "We are quite content with this. Let us just stay here, and the rest of you can go over and conquer the promised land. And we're content with this right here." And Moses' response to them is, "You know what you're saying? You're doing the very same thing that the scouts who had gone into the promised land and came back with bad reports did. That is, you are trying to demoralize your people by saying that two tribes are not going to be part of the conquest of the promised land. You are demoralizing the rest of your brothers. And that is a wicked thing to do. Because this task, the conquest of the promised land, is something that God wants the Israelites to do. And anything that you do to undermine that is wicked. It's rebellious." So the people of Gad and Reuben have a counterproposal that they make to Moses. They say, "Okay, we see that. We don't want to do that. We will send our fighters with the rest of Israel into the promised land and help conquer the promised land. And when that's done, then we will return to this land on this side of the Jordan, and we will stay here." And Moses' response to that is, "Fine. That's fine." So the real crux of the matter was that no one is justified in doing anything to discourage and demoralize the Israelites from doing what God had told them to do. Okay, so that's where things stand before we enter into the next book of the Old Testament, Deuteronomy. In the next book of in Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is almost entirely a speech that Moses gives to the people of Israel on the plains of Moab before they go into the promised land. And in that speech, he recounts the whole history of how the people of Israel got to where they are. What happened in Egypt, what happened when they came through the Sinai, what happened when they came up the Transjordan area and got to Moab. Then he reiterates the law that Moses had given, that God had given to Moses at Sinai, and all of the features of the distinctiveness to which the people of Israel have been called by God, and urging them to maintain that distinctiveness and live according to the law that God had given them. And then at the end of Deuteronomy, then it describes the death of Moses, and then Joshua picks up there, moving from the plains of Moab into the promised land to take it. Okay, so that's we're done with Numbers. Are there questions or comments?
Just some observations that clearly Moses is acting on behalf of God and his authority, but the scenario, as I look at it, is offensive to modern sensibilities, where you have a religious leader declaring essentially a holy war to wipe out the infidels and their influence, and then when you have captured women and children and you sort out the virgin females and keep them and then kill the children, male children and women as well. I just, as I thought about that, in modern times, people would be horrified at that. Mm-hmm. And yet, of course, we know that there's a different, bigger picture here. But right. I just wanted to bring that up.
Right. This was a special time and special circumstances. And I think that as I look at these books of the Old Testament, it's becoming clearer and clearer to me that God is painting in history, in the history of these times, a whole set of analogies and historical pictures that later he's going to draw upon to make points with respect to our existence as spiritual beings that stand before God. So these, what happened here, have analogous significance, and God is being very careful to structure things in a way that he can use those analogies. They're analogies that will be appropriate for what he's going to talk about later. I thought about that with respect to Moses. I mean, that's an awfully harsh punishment, it seems to me, for one slip-up, that he doesn't get to go into the promised land, on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think that he's creating an analogy that's important for him later. And that is, Moses was not the right leader then to go into the, to lead them into the promised land. Moses takes on a significance as the one who gave to the Israelites the law. He ends up taking on a significance that is not quite appropriate then for being the one who takes them into the promised land. And I think that God in history wants to create these pictures that he can then use later to talk about spiritual truths. Is that unfair to the humans that lived at that time? Well, no. I mean, God can, he doesn't do these things with no reason. Even with Moses, he doesn't give that punishment for no reason. There is a reason. As they go into the promised land and they kill everybody, there is a reason. They resisted this thing that God is doing. So, and the other thing is, we're just talking about people dying. We aren't talking about people's souls. And that's a different issue. And what is happening to the souls of these individuals? And that is more important, and that is a separate issue.
Thanks.
It seems like the question that was just asked about your answer was that God's going to draw on these and make them pictures in the future. And it seems like 1 Corinthians 10 is one of those places where Paul is reminding the people not to avoid the mistakes of Israel. And he specifically talks about what says in 10:1, for I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. I've heard a lot of people try to make these really close parallels between Moses striking the rock and that was sort of this picture of Christ being crucified, and that he had done it once before and then doing it twice again, even when he was told to just speak to it, that was, you know, that Christ was on the rock or Christ was a rock. And I don't know if that makes any sense to me anymore, but can you kind of explain maybe what Paul means by Christ was the rock? I mean, and does that have significance for why Moses was, I mean, because I think what you said about Moses being arrogant and thinking that he was not only separate from his people, but also that he was the one doing the miracle, makes a lot of sense to me. But is there a sense in which this is, I don't know, is there, can you kind of pick a question out in there?
Well, yeah. Some of it I think I can be helpful with, some of it I can't be helpful with. I've already mentioned that I have a short memory. I've looked at that passage, but I don't remember what I did with it. But let me talk about analogies for a second. I think that what God did in the Exodus and in the conquest of the Promised Land creates a whole box of analogies that he can draw upon to talk about spiritual things. And I think that's why he did that. But to say that X is analogous to Y isn't getting us very far. Because one has to know what is the point of relationship. What is it that is the same between X and Y? And there are all kinds of things that can be posited as being the same between X and Y. Analogies can always be misunderstood. So the trick in looking at the Old Testament is trying to figure out what is the intended analogy
of the New Testament writer?
Right.
Okay.
And there could be more than one point of similarity. There could be several. But I'm still working on this. This is a big project, and it's bigger than my brain capacity. But I think in the Old Testament we have analogies, but we've also got things that function more as allegories. That is, an analogy, what I'm thinking about with respect to analogy is, here's something in which the dynamics are the same as over here in what we're talking about in the New Testament. It's the same dynamics, just different clothes, just a different situation. But you can also have an analogy in which this incident, if we attach different values to the various things in this incident, it provides a convenient picture for something over here. Even though in this incident the dynamics may have been completely different, in fact, this meaning over here wasn't intended at all here. It's just a convenient way of illustrating what I want to say. And I think the Old Testament is used that way in the New Testament as well. So it becomes, it's very complicated. And it is difficult to know when you are doing things legitimately and when you're going way beyond the bounds of what's reasonable.
Right. So, okay. Just like, so in a sense, we have to kind of figure out, in this case, is Paul really trying to make a one-to-one correspondence that in the Old Testament, Jesus, in this weird, mystical way, was the rock? Or is he really trying to say something else?
Right. Yeah. It's possible that what he's doing there is saying, you know, there's an incident here.
Yeah.
And that works as a really great illustration for what I want to say here.
Right. Which makes it all more mysterious anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.
Mm-hmm. You talked about in the end of 31 about the cleansing that went on was a moral cleansing, and the plague was earlier. You talked about the plague could have been the killing of the 24,000.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that it's actually a plague, and that they're cleansing things, that it's like a sexually transmitted disease, and they're killing all the people who had sex in the Midianites, and mm-hmm. those that haven't, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a possibility here?
Well, I have heard that before, and I think that is a possibility that. That one of the factors for why God is having them kill all these people is because of the consequences that would come from them not doing it, that is through sexually transmitted diseases. That's not ultimately satisfying to me as the ultimate reason for why God is having that done. Because he could have solved that a different way. I mean, he could have wiped out the disease. He could have made the Israelites immune to it or whatever. There are other ways he could have solved that problem. So ultimately, it's not satisfying to me that's the end reason why he's having them kill all the women. But I think that could be a related factor. One more, and then I have to let you go.
This land the Israelites are coming into, this is where Abraham was when the drought struck and they had to go to Egypt.
Right.
His sons had to go to Egypt. So then they leave, they go down to Goshen, they're fruitful and multiply, and all they're doing is coming back to the land promised to Abraham, right?
That's right.
And so with 40 years advance notice, these people know they're coming. I mean, you can't miss this.
Right.
I was watching Dehan on the Bible show this morning. He was having trouble with this wiping out all these people and all this. And his teacher was saying they had 40 years to repent. They had 40 years to admit that the Israel's God was God. They had 40 years to clean up their culture and open their arms to the people of God. And when God's people showed up, it wasn't God's people they were rejecting. It was God's people's God.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of made a lot of sense to me, mm-hmm. in that this was a people who would feed their children to a burning God. You know, and this was a horribly polytheistic with vicious and self-indulgent God characters that they had devoted themselves to.
Right.
And what the Israelites were offering them was the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of Moses. And that was really what they were saying no to. And so a God who is saying, you shall not give your children to the fire to be burned, and you shall not mate indiscriminately like wild dogs, and you know, et cetera, et cetera, they rejected. And given 40 years of advance notice, it was pretty clear No, the jig was up. And in that sense, with those things, is it so terrible that God would make the Israelites pay this price of this effort of cleansing the land before they took it, before they inherited it, so to speak?
Right. No, I think that's right. And it is interesting that there are a few who respond differently. I mean, Rahab is an example of that.
Example they gave.
So we do have a few who have come to understand what's happening and have responded rightly. Okay, thanks.